This is Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Video chat has suddenly become a new way of life. You're probably Zooming your work meetings or maybe a yoga class, FaceTiming for happy hour with friends.
Do you have any health concerns right now about him?
But what about a new mom who doesn't have much money or a stable home and has worries about her newborn baby?
I don't know what it is. He has like a bunch of little rashes.
What if you can't go to a doctor or you just need some advice on what to do?
Do they come and go or does it stay in that particular spot?
This is actually a mom talking over Zoom video chat with a community health worker who, prior to COVID-19, used to come and visit her at home. But is that actually helpful? And what about when a social worker has to check on a foster child? Can video technology work for those kinds of home visits too? Reporter Deepa Fernandez looks into it.
When the stay-home order was given in LA County, Ava Moten couldn't shake one surging feeling. She runs a home visiting program for at-risk families in South LA, and she wondered, what will happen to all the people she helps?
I mean, it's a high anxiety.
Her organization, Shields for Families, serves parents who've just had a baby and may also be experiencing homelessness, poverty, or recovering from substance abuse. Sending a community health worker to homes of vulnerable families can often be the difference between the baby getting enough formula and a regular diaper change, or not.
Diapers is really expensive, so we make sure every single visit we're taking diapers in the home, we're taking wipes in the home, we're taking clothes in the home.
But when you can't visit, how do you help families in need?
You know, we're not having any contact. We're basically dropping off diapers and other resources in a safe, designated area. We'll call the family, hey, we're dropping off, we sit in our car.
There are so many other needs that the home visitors help with too. Making sure the baby is enrolled in Medi-Cal and mom knows to take the baby for well visits. Looking out for possible early warning signs of developmental delays. Checking out the home for hazards for small children. How does all this happen in coronavirus times?
I always felt like face-to-face contact was like the best method, being there hands-on, modeling behaviors. So I don't know if I would have looked at virtual video chatting.
As social service organizations rushed to figure out how to keep providing services, one woman's telephone started ringing.
We have had service providers in early intervention calling us.
Angela Rao's expertise is home visiting, but doing it via video conference.
We have had individuals that are working in the foster care system, individuals in childcare, all reaching out to us and saying, how do we do this? What do we need to think about? What platforms do we need to use?
She works for a national organization called Parents as Teachers, which connects families to professionals to help them during a child's early years. Rao has been leading webinars for organizations like Shields for Families to train them in how to make video home visits successful. Yet, Rao says, prior to COVID-19 times, without studies showing what their families and partner organizations were telling them about how successful the video visits were, sometimes even preferable to someone going into the home, it was hard to convince policymakers that this method worked.
Just didn't seem like people were wanting to do it, wanting to put money to sustain the work, and it was so frustrating.
Sometimes these policymakers take a very provincial approach.
Dorian Traub is an associate professor of social work at USC, and she too has been pushing for years to use video conferencing more widely for home visiting programs for one big reason. More families could be served because of the cost savings, and more benefit could spread in the community beyond just the small group of very high-risk families who currently receive an in-home visit. Also, the professional providing the service can video chat more frequently, even be on call for moments of crisis, and not have to wait for the monthly in-home visit. But state, federal, and county funding agencies have not been willing.
And in some ways, there's more of this paternalistic approach of, I'm going to dictate to you what will improve your parenting, rather than hearing from the consumer what they wanted, needed, and what helped.
trial points out that new parents today that need services from maternal and infant health programs are part of a generation that uses technology for everything.
What they were asking for were digital solutions to parenting challenges. They didn't necessarily want somebody in their home.
And then COVID-19 meant community health workers couldn't make their home visits.
Oh my God, he's so cute.
Enter video conferencing.
I can see his little eye.
I've been invited into a Zoom call between community health worker Perla Montenegro of Shields for Families and a new mum in South LA, Jennifer Rodriguez.
I don't know if the milk like comes in, like rushes out.
Her baby is 1 month old, and right now she's sheltering in place with her mum and siblings in the Jordan Downs projects.
He gets so frustrated and he just like starts squirming around.
As Montenegro asks Rodriguez a bunch of questions about the baby's development.
So it takes him a little bit to adjust.
Yeah.
And offers tips and advice. The young mom cradles her one-month-old.
Do you sing something?
Like, no, I just make up like random stuff.
Over the course of the call, she breastfeeds, she changes his diaper, her younger brother comes in. And all in all, it seems like a productive visit. Dorian Trobe of USC says this is generally how they go.
My hope is that we continue to offer virtual services after stay-at-home orders are lifted, because I think this is a positive outcome of a terrible situation, in that it has moved the needle in several industries that were really reluctant to offer virtual services to families.
One of these places where home visits were rarely, if ever, done via video conferencing is child welfare. But
this entire situation with the coronavirus pandemic has changed the way that we do a lot of the work.
Bobby Cagle runs the Department of Children and Family Services. Courts have stopped all but the most urgent visits, and DCFS has had to move quickly to make sure its 18,000 children in foster care and the 6,000 pending cases can continue check-ins via video chat where possible. It's been a learning curve for everyone, Cagle says.
I'm 53, and this crisis was the first time that I had used FaceTime.
It gave him a deep understanding of what foster parents, many of whom are grandparents, might experience.
The technology divide, and making sure that our caregivers have the kind of technology in order to be able to carry these out. If they don't, then we have no other option but to make those in-person contacts, because we have to make the monthly visits.
Parents who've had a child removed and are going through the process to reunify now almost always have to video chat with their kids when they normally would visit in person.
Mommy,
okay,
sit down here.
That's been very hard for Christina's four-year-old to understand. We can't use Christina's last name as the case is pending in the child welfare system.
Over there.
Video chatting with a four-year-old for hours is hard.
She can't really engage for that long, 2 or 3 hours.
This mum is not a fan of video conferencing, and she worries about how her daughter is processing the fact that she hasn't actually seen her in person for weeks, despite repeated explanations. So she watches little videos of their previous playground visits to keep her spirits up. And while the child welfare system may stick to in-person visits for the long term, this crisis may be the time when other social workers learn to love the video chats. For KCRW, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
Deepa Fernandez is a reporting fellow at Pacific Oaks College, which is funded in part by First 5 LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Social distancing, not crowding together, being at least 6 feet apart. That's the watchword of the day. But social distancing is more possible for some than others. At the immigrant detention facility up in Adelanto, right now, there are more than 1,300 people who definitely cannot socially distance from one another. Immigrant rights attorneys have been fighting to get their clients out of Adelanto and to keep new inmates from being put in because of the dangers posed by the coronavirus in such close quarters. And they're having some success. Talia Inlender is a supervising senior staff attorney for the Immigrants' Rights Project at Public Counsel. Public Counsel is a pro bono public interest law firm, and she's with us right now. Talia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, a little bit about Adelanto. It's up there in the high desert. This is near Hesperia, about 80 miles northeast of downtown L.A. What is the situation like at that facility? Can you describe the living conditions?
Sure. It's a really desperate situation right now. So it's a very large facility, one of the biggest in the country. It's run by a private corporation that ICE contracts with called Geo Group. And it can house over 1,900 people. Our understanding is that at present, it's housing a bit over 1,300 people. There are two wings to the facility holding both men and women. And the housing conditions are extremely crowded. They're dorm-like conditions on the west side of the facility. There are large dorms, and within each dorm, there are separate rooms that hold anywhere between 4 and 8 people at a time in bunk beds. Those 4 to 8 people share an open toilet. That's in the dorm room, and then they share showers with about 100 other detainees who are located in the same large area. So you're talking about very close quarters with a lot of people interacting.
I know ICE, this is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they're continuing to detain more people even now during this pandemic.
That's right. It's just unconscionable. And that's something that Public Counsel has really fought hard against. So on March 16th, the day that the rest of the city was shutting down under orders from the mayor, ICE was out doing business as usual, picking up people in our communities at their homes and bringing them to the detention facility with almost no protections. There were no masks used. People who were being arrested were not given gloves, masks, no protections at all, held in close quarters throughout their arrest and transport, and then dumped into these dorm rooms with 100 other people. And so every single exposure that they had on the outside was then brought into these really close quarters where they're in contact, you know, with other people who have been detained for a long time, as well as the staff.
Has anybody tested positive, guards or inmates at Adelanto? We've heard this at other facilities, right?
So far out of Adelanto, they haven't reported any positive tests, but we also know that testing is just not happening at any kind of scale. The government, in a declaration signed on March 26, attested that they had tested only 2 people in the entire facility. They submitted a subsequent declaration on April 4th and had only tested the same 2 people. You know, thankfully, there have been no positive tests reported, but that also makes us extremely worried because we know that what that actually reflects is that they're just not doing enough testing.
They're not doing testing, but what about taking precautions, protective equipment to make sure that there's no possibility, or at least the least amount of possibility that something like this could spread so easily?
You know, ICE has been extremely, extremely slow to adopt even minimal precautions. Our clients have not been provided with masks. Most of the guards, at least as of last week, were not wearing masks in the facility. Some had gloves, but our clients did not have regular access to gloves. So just really, you know, the kinds of protective equipment that people are and precautions people are taking on the outside are not available on the inside. One really stark example of that is soap, right? One thing we're hearing is, you know, we need to be washing our hands constantly. And we heard from one of our clients last week in the women's dorm that 4 days went by when they had no soap. They ran out. People were using, you know, shampoo, trying to, you know, tie their shirts around their faces and around their hands to protect themselves. It is a really, really scary, scary picture.
What about people who are at most at risk at Adelanto? Have you been successful in trying to get some people out of there based on the danger that's posed to them?
Yes, there have been federal lawsuits filed on behalf of people with serious medical vulnerabilities, and we have had some success in getting them out. But the number of people you know, the individual, you know, cases that we're able to file is limited compared to the vast number of people that are in the facility right now. We have a federal court here that, you know, is hearing these claims, is understanding, you know, the gravity of the situation, and then that there are really constitutional violations going on when people are held during pandemics in a setting where they cannot protect themselves. And so we are getting some people out, but we know that, you know, that's just a fraction of the people on the inside.
The ACLU has sued to force ICE to make it possible for these detainees at Adelanto and other places, too, to be able to socially be distant from one another. That would mean releasing a lot of folks from this facility. Is that right?
That's right. You know, and that's what we know needs to happen. And the CDC has said over and over again, the number one prevention tool is social distancing. And that is just not physically possible in a detention setting like Adelanto. And the days are passing. And it is, you know, with each day, the risk grows greater. So so the ACLU sued yesterday to try to reduce the number of people at Adelanto to such a number where people could actually practice social distancing in the facility. And that would mean, you know, some of those dorm rooms I described earlier that hold 4 to 8 people, they should be holding one person each that has access to their own toilet.
So that means a lot of people would have to go somewhere else, right? Where would they go?
Well, you know, many people who are detained by immigration, I would say the majority of people have strong ties to the community. They have their families here, their loved ones. You know, they have lived here sometimes for decades and decades. So there are many, many people who have places to go, families and communities that are ready and willing to take them in and help them. For those who don't, you know, there are a number of people at Adelanto who are recent asylum seekers, people who are seeking refuge in this country and have landed here at perhaps the most inopportune time. And we are working hard along with many community groups across the country to find appropriate and safe housing for those people. And it's just been amazing to see how people have stepped up in this time of need. And so, you know, working together, I'm confident that we can find safe solutions for people who will be released.
You and other lawyers, you can't go visit your clients during this pandemic, obviously, has everything shut down. This past Saturday, a federal judge ruled that you had to be able to communicate with your clients by phone. Why was that decision necessary, do you think?
That decision is absolutely critical. Since the middle of March, we have struggled to set up confidential communications with our clients. We're not able to go in person safely to visit the facility. And so we're required to communicate with them by phone. But there was, until Saturday, really no reliable system for setting up confidential calls with our clients in Adelanto. And in the past few days, even, we've seen a huge change where we've been able to set up calls with our clients within a 24-hour period and have extended confidential communication with them, which has made a big difference. Of course, it is not the same as meeting in person. We still cannot prepare in the ways that we usually do for our clients' cases, but it is meaningfully different to be able to have reliable confidential communications with our clients.
I want to thank you for joining us today, Talia Inlander with the Immigrants' Rights Project over at Public Counsel. Talia, thank you.
Thank you. Take good care.
By the way, we reached out to ICE to get a response to this story. We haven't heard back yet, but in a statement last week to USA Today, they said, quote, utilizing CDC guidance along with the advice of medical professionals, ICE may place individuals in a number of alternatives to detention options. Back with Greater LA, now on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. As we've mentioned on the show before, galleries and museums here in LA have been closed for a while for the COVID-19 pandemic, but there is one LA institution that shut its doors for now and that's had a lot of commotion these past few weeks. Things going on. LACMA, a.k.a. the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, is taking down 4 buildings, taking them down to make room for a new $750 million structure. Demolition began last week. Some people are not happy about it. Frances Anderton heads up KCRW's Design and Architecture desk, and she joins me now to talk about this controversial project. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
You and I were talking about this even before this pandemic. Obviously, a lot of people are not happy with the way LACMA is going. But you did get a chance to check out LACMA, what's going on the campus there. What does it look like?
Yes, this past Sunday, Easter Sunday, I drove up to LACMA. I wasn't the only one. There were other looky-loos like me. And what you see is much of the area around the old buildings. By old, I mean the Bing Theatre, the Amundsen, the Art of the Americas building, and the Hammer buildings. These are the early buildings on the block. They're all wrapped by a fairly tall fence. There's tarps around it. You can't see too much of what's going. But what you can see is that the Bing no longer exists, and that the other buildings I've mentioned, already there is a start on breaking down those buildings. What you see if you peek through the fence is a giant pile of rubble where once the Bing stood.
Well, let's dig into it for a moment, Francis, because number one, this was expected. The demolition had been planned. This was all supposed to happen in the first place. So it's not like this was happening just under the cover of COVID, right?
No, except that that's somehow how it got perceived. And there has been an outpouring on social media from people who are really, really upset and sort of have this feeling that this was done under the cover of night. Even Kenneth Turan, the longtime LA Times film critic who just retired, which is another story in itself, sad to see him go. But he wrote last week on Twitter, he wrote, "Oh my God, I'd not focused on the fact that LACMA's 600-seat Leo Bing Theatre, one of the best of LA movie showcases, was about to be demolished. What a shock." So people did know it was coming, but somehow seeing the reality of it was a shock.
A lot of construction projects, Francis, have been on hold since the pandemic began. Does this mean the rebuilding of LACMA is considered an essential activity?
Well, certainly according to LACMA, which has been writing this up on its website, and they wrote both the county and city of Los Angeles have declared building construction to be an essential activity. And they say the county has strongly urged us to continue moving forward in our work in the construction of our new building for the permanent collection. Now, it is true that there are timeposts attached to construction projects. There are large loans that are contingent on meeting timeposts. Construction is a complex project, and it is kind of hard to postpone. And this demolition had been billboarded for months. But the fact that it took place right now, when, as somebody on Twitter pointed out, you know, people aren't allowed to gather for protests, was felt to be a kind of heartless action on the part of LACMA. And I should absolutely add, that doesn't mean everybody feels like that.
I want to talk more about the people who have been protesting this and the ads and the newspapers that they've put out and people really trying to, I mean, the Save LACMA groups, one of which is genuine and the other of which we're not absolutely sure where it came from. I mean, there are so many different angles to this story. Weren't we just hearing about all these efforts to stop construction?
Yes. In the last few months, there has been an intensification of efforts to try and stop the construction. You mentioned that there's two campaigns that both essentially are referred to as Save LACMA. One of them is still working very hard to get a measure on the November ballot that would cap the county's, i.e. the taxpayers' financial obligation to this project. And they're not going to give up, even though this demolition has happened. So they can't actually stop the project. They can only, in their view, sort of contain the damage, I guess. And that means having some level of public control over what gets built and what expenditure happens. I did speak with Rob Holman. He helms the campaign Save LACMA. And what he said is there's something particularly jarring about doing the demolition at this time because of the suffering surrounding COVID-19 and the need for monies to be spent on providing PPE and generally putting all our resources in that direction. And he said, quote, "Sadly, LACMA is currently hurting the community rather than help heal it, which is not what an arts institution should do." Now, of course, again, there are supporters of this project who will say, "This is fantastic. We're building something for the future." Michael Govan himself said, "This is an optimistic step forward in this rather pessimistic moment that we're in." And he's called the project an investment in the city's future, says it's going to be an engine of job creation and economic recovery, anticipates up to 4,000 jobs being created around this project, says it's almost 90% funded. So the controversy continues, even as the buildings turn into a pile of rubble.
All of the controversy, obviously, Francis, notwithstanding, and a pandemic, obviously, before us. When is this construction going to end? And you know, what kind of time frame are we talking about?
Well, they say demolition is set to be completed this summer. The building is estimated to be completed in late 2023. Those numbers can always change. But no, a number of big construction projects are definitely moving ahead, as many of us are sheltering in place, feeling like the world is on hold.
KCRW's Francis Anderton at the Design and Architecture Desk. Francis, thank you.
You're very welcome, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Join us Monday through Thursday at 1 and 6:30 on KCRW. Always online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Share your thoughts as well. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Mooney, Danielle Chiriguayo, Sonia Geis, Kat Yor, Paul Smith, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen today. Some at home, some at the studio, all working tirelessly to keep you informed. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and time. Take care of yourself. Have a great day.